All right, this is Seth Davis. I'm here with H. Gelfand. He's a professor at James Madison University. It is Thursday, October 25th at 3:39 p.m. It is a cloudy afternoon. H., would you mind just stating your name, H., and what you do?
Yes, hello, I'm H., and I teach in the history department. I also teach interdisciplinary liberal studies and honors.
Awesome. What brought you to Harrisonburg?
I got offered a job here.
Really?
Yes.
Where do you come from originally?
I grew up in northern New Jersey, right outside of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed there until I was 17. Do you want me to tell you the whole story?
Yes, please.
Okay, so I was there until I was 17 when I graduated high school. Then I went to the University of Georgia, where I got my undergraduate degree. Then I went to the University of Kentucky for a year and a half and got my first master's degree. Then I moved back to Athens, Georgia, and I worked for a history professor for 2 years. Then I got my second master's degree in history. Then I moved to Tucson and went to the University of Arizona, where I got my history PhD. And then I moved for 1 year to Phoenix, where I taught at Arizona State University. Then I moved back to Tucson and taught for 2 years at University of Arizona. And then I started teaching here.
Awesome.
In a nutshell, that's the whole thing.
Okay. What made you get into
We need no other questions.
Field? No other questions?
What got me into history?
Yeah.
So it's a strange story, but I'll give you the abbreviated version. So in between what I just told you, I had graduated from the University of Kentucky, and the degree was in diplomacy, and the goal was that I was going to work for something called the Foreign Agriculture Service, and the idea was that I was going to go to Africa and attempt to help people figure out more efficient methods of agriculture so that in drought or, I guess you would say, like, areas stricken with some sort of, like, horrible problem that we would go over education as to how to plant better, how to plant more diverse or something like that. And while I was in the process of training for that, the federal government eliminated the entire project.
Oh, wow.
So I was left with no job. And so I was trying to figure out what to do. So I went back to Athens where I knew a bunch of people, and I was trying to find a job and I could not find a job. And one day I was walking by the history building at the University of Georgia and there was this light on. And it was the office of this professor who I'd had when I was a freshman. So we're talking like 6 years before that. So just sort of out of desperation, I went up to his office and I was just like, I think he remembered my face, but not my name. Mm-hmm. I had no idea who I was. And I told him my situation and I said, I just need a job. Do you know of anything? And he said, no. And as I was shutting the door, he said, wait, come back. And I went back in and he made a phone call and he had this conversation. He said, my best friend in the department just found out today that he has cancer, and he's going to need somebody to organize all of the papers in his world so that all of it can be organized and given to the library before he dies. Could you do that? And I'm like, fuck yeah. So that's how it happened.
All right. Other than teaching, what have you done with your history degree?
Well, I've done a bunch of things. So when I went out to the University of Arizona, I realized that because getting a PhD is really intense, that I was going to need something to kind of take my mind off of the intensity. So I don't know how or why it occurred to me now, but one day Tucson has this enormous Air Force base in it because all of the planes that the military stores, they're all stored at this Air Force base.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tens of thousands of airplanes. So this very sort of strange facility is all around the city of Tucson. And so one day I just drove to the Air Force Base. This is way before 9/11 when you could still drive on military
yeah.
bases. And I met up with the base cultural resources manager. And I said to her, I'm H, I have a PhD, or I'm getting a PhD. I said, do you have something that I could do as a volunteer job? And she's like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I have no idea what needs to be done. And she said, we have a couple of old airplane hangars that we're trying to get preserved. You could write the reports on them. And I'm like, fuck yeah. So every Friday, because I didn't have class on Fridays, I just go sit in this tiny little like wooden building at this Air Force base that was built during World War II. And I would just go over all of these architectural plans and all these logs. And I wrote these two reports. And then one day, just by some like weird coincidence, this other graduate student said to me, don't you do something at the Air Force? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, because I'm looking for a summer job, and I saw this, and I printed it out for you. And it was an advertisement for a job working for the Air Force doing historic preservation work, which was exactly what I was doing for the Air Force in Tucson. The only problem was that this was like on, I don't know, say like a Wednesday, and the due date was on the previous Monday. So I was like, so I called the phone number and I said to the guy, you know, I realized I'm a couple days late. Have you already filled the position? And he said, do you have a fax machine? And, you know, history department had a fax. So I faxed him my resume, and 5 minutes later he calls back. He says, I want you to apply right now. And I'm like, okay. So I apply and I get this job. And so what it led to is that all of the summers of my PhD, I was employed by the Air Force.
Wow.
And so I got to go to all these Air Force bases around the country. So if you look at all of these books here that have these stealth fighters on them,
mm-hmm.
I helped to write or edit all of those.
Really?
And those were all out of an Air Force base in New Mexico. And then I was at Air Force Base in Virginia, down in Hampton, Virginia. I was down there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was at an Air Force Base outside of Tacoma, Washington. That was one summer. And then one summer I spent living in Santa Barbara, even though there's not an Air Force Base there. There was a government contracting firm that was doing a big project, so I lived there. And so I got all these publications and I got all this expertise in historic preservation. So that's part of what I do now on the side of the teaching part, is I'm the head of a historic preservation organization in New Jersey.
Really?
And it's called the Bergen County Historical Society. That's, you can see that certificate up there.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what I do is I am the person who advocates for all of these buildings being kept standing around. This is a county that is across the Hudson River from Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the greater New York City metro. So there's, as you might imagine, a lot of pressure with development. Yeah. Because people want to make a lot of money. So right now, I don't know if I've told you this before, but right now the big project that we're working on is a place called the Van Gelder Studio,
mm-hmm.
which I did not even know about. We have a professor in the history department named Lamont King, who's a jazz musician. And Lamont and I talk about music all the time. And one day he gave me this this John Coltrane CD. And he said, you should listen to this. And I'm like, okay. And I'm reading all the liner notes, and I see that it's recorded at this place that's in a town up in the county where I grew up. And I'm like, so I called Lamont, and I'm like, what is the deal with this studio? He goes, it's the most important music studio in the world. He's like, how do you not know about it? And I'm like, I have no idea. So the next summer, I go up to New Jersey, and I look the place up in the phone book, and I call. And the guy at the time was 92.
Really?
And he had built the studio in 1958. It's designed by a couple of students of Frank Lloyd Wright's. And it's believed to be the first music studio that was ever designed and built as a music studio.
Wow.
Because most of them are just in other buildings.
Yeah.
Like Sun Studios, where Elvis still... It's literally just a storefront.
Mm-hmm.
And then NBC and CBS, they did all these jazz and rock and roll recordings in New York City, but they're all just in these office buildings. So I've been the lead person on this big effort to get the building saved.
That's incredible.
So it's a really... incredible project. John Coltrane recorded what a lot of people consider to be the most important recording of all of music, which is called The Love Supreme,
mm-hmm.
in that studio.
Wow.
Yeah. And then his last recording, which came out just after he died, he was a heroin addict, and mm-hmm. he died the year that I was born. And a couple months later, his final CD came out. It's called Interstellar Space. And that's the specific recording that if you read Beyonce, Kendrick Lamar, Dr. Dre, all these people, they say this is the piece of music that created hip-hop.
Really?
So it's just kind of interesting. So the tail end of his career, the beginning and the end, his two big recordings are in that studio, yeah.
I've just really gotten into Kendrick Lamar, so I should probably check that out.
You should check, yeah. If you listen to A Love Supreme, it's this very, very sort of beautiful, interesting recording where he attempts to bring in a lot of tribal music from various places in Africa. It's a very, very interesting recording. Yeah, that a lot of people have thought about. But Interstellar Space is a totally different ballgame. You might really like that. Yeah, it's a little bit out there. But
I'll check it out.
It's kind of fun.
Going back to your where you grew up in New Jersey, do you mind telling me a little bit about your childhood?
Well, I guess the sort of kicker of it is that I'm adopted.
Really?
Which I did not know. So I basically just, you know, grew up in this very modest middle-class household, older sister, parents. My dad was a superintendent for a school system. My mom was the vice president of a company that makes furniture fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just kind of ordinary middle class New Jersey lifestyle. You know, nothing particularly fancy. You know, like a lot of other people, you know, went to New York all the time to do. For a while, my parents were really big into going to Broadway musicals, so we did a lot of that, and yeah, it was kind of average lifestyle. Anyway.
All right. Let me find another question to ask. I have a lot, so don't worry. Let's see.
You're looking to ask all of them.
Huh?
You can ask all of them.
Okay. Let's see. All right, so you mentioned that these books here you helped write. Are there any books that you've written yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's called Sea Change at Annapolis. It's about the Naval Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that... So one of these summers that I had been working for the Air Force, I was working at the Pentagon. And it's sort of a funny story, because the woman who is my supervisor just decided from day one to dislike me. So I called the supervisor, and I was just like, I don't know what to do, because this woman apparently is not going to like me. So he then arranged for me to get a job working for the National Park Service for the summer.
Really?
Doing the same thing, just with the National Park Service. So that turned out to be a much, much better job.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who was my boss, who has this incredible title, her title is the Keeper of the National Register of Historic Places.
Ooh.
So she's like in charge of making all the decisions about what gets listed and not listed in terms of historic purposes. So, once a week, I had to go to the Library of Congress and get her books for her. And the Library of Congress is not like most libraries. You make a request, and then hours later, somebody arrives with your books. Because they have so many books there, everything is in storage. So, a couple weeks before... There's this one day that I go, a couple weeks before, this friend of mine, whose dad was an Air Force general down at Langley Air Force Base in Hampton, invited me to come down for this big party weekend that they were going to have. And he said, is there any way you can, on the way down here, can you stop in Annapolis and pick this friend of ours up? And I'm like, whatever. So this kid went to the Naval Academy, which I'd never been to before. So I go and I pick him up, and then we have like a 3-hour ride down to Hampton. So we're chatting the whole way, and I'm learning all the stuff about the Naval Academy. And then I bring him back, and he says, have you ever gone on the grand tour of the Naval Academy? And I said, no. He's like, well, then why don't I show you around? So I look around, and I'm like, you know, very interesting place. I don't know if you've been there before, but I've been to West Point a bunch of times because it's right by New York City. But so this one afternoon, I'm just waiting for these fucking books at the Library of Congress, and I needed to pick a topic for my dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just type into the computer Naval Academy, and almost nothing comes up. And then you type in West Point, and it's like, every year, dozens of books are written about West Point because all these Civil War generals came from there, and so people are like obsessed with West Point. And then all the World War II generals. So the next day, I call over to the Naval Academy library. I do what you're not supposed to do. I call the reference desk. And I'm like, you know, here's who I am, and I need a topic. Do you think, you know, the woman said, you know, what kind of things are you interested in? And I said, I've been envisioning doing something that either deals with race or ethnicity or gender, or maybe all three of them. And she said, what are you doing at lunchtime tomorrow? And I said, nothing. She said, can you drive over here? I said, yeah. She said, I'll arrange for a tour of the archive. And I said, okay. Well, as it turned out, I got the history librarian. And so I get over there, and she and the archivist and I were walking through the archive. And I don't know if you've ever seen like a documentary archive. It's basically rafters that are filled with boxes from the floor to the ceiling. And this guy says, well, you know, we have like these 57 boxes about the integration of black people here that have never been opened. So I have no idea what's in them. And we go down the next row, and he says, this entire wall is papers about the integration of women. These things have never been opened. And I'm like, so I called my dissertation advisor back in Tucson. I said, I think I have a topic. There's like hundreds of boxes of shit that has not been opened. So so I ended up living at the Naval Academy for 2 years. And the guy who was the admiral who headed up the school was John McCain's roommate for all 4 years.
Wow.
And so I subsequently later on got to know John McCain, and John McCain wrote the foreword to the book.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's sort of like a really fun topic. Yeah. Fun project. Living in a place like that was a really extraordinary experience. It was a very, very interesting thing. It was a very, very intense and memorable 2 years of my life. Yeah. And then the dissertation turned into a book.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's very exciting.
So you mentioned you knew John McCain, and yeah. I see there he wrote you a personal autograph.
Yeah.
Do you mind sharing a little bit about any encounters you had with John McCain, personal stories? Yeah,
so what happened is, so one of the nice things about the PhD program at the University of Arizona is that they allow graduate students to teach their own classes, so that when we go on the job market, we've now taught our own classes, which is basically how I got the job here, because by the time I had taught here, I'd already taught 9 different classes, and mostly at University of Arizona, a few at Arizona State. And so one of the classes that I was teaching every summer is a class called Vietnam and the Cold War. It's a Vietnam War class. And it's done in what is called the summer pre-session there, which is a 3-week period. So you go to class every day for 4 hours, Monday through Friday for 3 weeks. So it's very intense. Students are only allowed to take one class at a time. And what's really awesome is, because we're together all day, it's just a very intense learning experience, because you're just sort of living and breathing only this. Well, because it's also so short, you can't really assign very long books.
Yeah.
So John McCain has this one of his autobiographies, which covers the time of Vietnam, so I signed it. And so the first year, I just sent him a letter, and I just said, I'm teaching this class, they're reading a book, do you want to come? I hear nothing. Second year, same thing, nothing. Third year, I don't know why I did it the third year, but I faxed the invitation, and maybe like 2 weeks before the class, and then on the last week, I want to say it was like on Wednesday, I get done teaching, and I'm leaving the building, and one of the history secretaries comes running after me. She's like, don't leave yet, don't leave. And I'm like, what's the problem? And she hands me this piece of paper. She goes, you have to call this number. And I'm like, what is this number? She goes, it's John McCain's office. And I'm like, oh, dear God. So I call, and it's his scheduler up in Phoenix. Phoenix is about an hour and a half to 2-hour drive from Tucson. So I call, and the woman says, McCain is coming tomorrow to Tucson. Do you want to come to your class? And I'm like, fuck yeah. And she's like, you can only spend 15 minutes. And I'm like, if you can spend 15 seconds, that's great. So I'll tell you this story because it's actually so funny. So our class is being held in the business school. Mm-hmm. And the College of Business in Arizona is this massive thing. It's very highly ranked. And so they have a building which is sort of like a big rectangle. And there's this huge outdoor atrium in the middle. And it has, like, all these palm trees, and it has, like, a waterfall and a pond and all this stuff. It's very beautiful. And our classroom was off of this courtyard. And, but that's sort of sunken into the ground. So to get to our classroom, you have to actually enter from the floor above, which is facing the street. So I get all dressed up. I'm outside by the street waiting for McCain to show up. I have no idea how McCain is showing, because I don't know what the protocol is for a senator coming to campus. So I don't know if there's going to be like a police escort or a helicopter. I have no idea what's going to happen. So I'm waiting and waiting, and all of a sudden, like 10 cop cars come, like sirens full blast, come pull up before the building, and these dudes all go running in the building, and I'm like, holy shit, this is awesome. So I said to one of them, I said, are you here for John McCain? And he goes, no, I'm here for the naked guy. And I'm like, I have no idea what that means. I'm just like, okay. And then this Honda Accord pulls up, and out pops John McCain. And McCain, Seth, I'm just like totally dumbfounded, because there he is.
Yeah.
I've seen it on TV like a million times. And he was a lot shorter and a lot more crippled than I had anticipated he would be. And so I walked up to him and I shook his hand, and he said, what's with all the cop cars? And I said, I'm not really sure exactly. I thought maybe they were coming for you. And he's like, for me? And he just started laughing. He's like, I'm not that important. Like, okay. So we go up these stairs into the building and then down the stairs. And when we are approaching the waterfall part, there's this homeless dude who just decided to take his clothes off and just go swimming in this pond. So as McCain and I are walking by, the guy is like this, junk out right in front of us. And McCain just stops, and he looks at me, and he says, you know, I've been a guest at Arizona State University many times. They've never arranged to have a naked guy to greet me. I was just like, and at that moment, I knew that he was going to be, like, totally awesome.
Yeah.
So so instead of spending the 15 minutes, he spent the entire 4 hours with our class.
Wow.
And his son, if you saw, I don't know if you watched the funeral, the son that was sitting with his wife, who was in the Navy now, he was graduating high school that night.
Oh, really?
And McCain was late to the graduation because he was in my class.
Wow.
And he first lectured, and then when he got done lecturing, his assistant who drove him, she was like sort of hinting that they needed to leave to get on the road back to Phoenix. And he comes up to me, he whispers in my ear, and he says, "Do you mind if I talk to all of your students individually?" And I'm like, "I'm sure they would love it." They all had their books. And so he sat at a desk, and each one of them came and sat and talked to him face, and he asked, you know, "Who are you? Where are you from? What's your major? What's your life plan?" He signed their books, and up until he just died, two of those students were still working for him, one in Phoenix and one in D.C. That's how fucking nice he was. So on the way out, he said to me, I didn't even ask, like, "Who are you? What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a history PhD student." And he said, "What are you studying?" And I said, "Well, I'm writing my dissertation. It's about the Naval Academy." And he goes, "Do you know that I went there?" And I'm like, "Yeah, because your roommate is the guy that ran the school for the 2 years." And he's like, "You know Chuck Larson?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And then he looked at me all funny. He was like, "Oh." And I was like, "Okay, whatever." And he said, "If you ever write it up as a book, I'll write the foreword to the book." So he wrote the foreword to the book.
That's amazing.
So since this woman from my class got hired as one of his staffers, every time he came to Tucson, she would email me and say, "McCain's going to be here or there," or whatever. So I have all this shit with his signature on it. I have books, t-shirts, pictures, all this stuff.
Wow.
So sometimes he was just going to, like, an Elks Lodge. Sometimes he was going to, like, speak to some class. Sometimes he was just going to a bookstore or whatever, and I would always go. And every time that he saw me, I don't think he had any idea what my name was, but he would go like this. He would go, "You're the Naval Academy guy. I know you." And I'm like, "Yeah." And he would say, he would always ask the same thing. He would say, "Tell me a story that didn't end up in the book."
Really?
And then I would just tell him some random story. And so the last time I saw him, which was the last conversation I ever had with him, he said, "Tell me a story that I don't know. What was not in the book?" And I said, "Well," I said, "your roommate was Chuck Larson, and Larson was the admiral who was running the Naval Academy." And I said, "I wrote a letter to Admiral Larson asking if I could come do all this research at the Naval Academy. And in the letter, I asked to go through something that's called the Plebe Summer, which is like the initial training that all the kids there go through. And I thought it would be, as an outsider, a really quick and easy way for me to learn everything, because it's simultaneously like a total military indoctrination, a total Naval Academy education, like the whole overview of the history. And every day you run like 8 miles and you do like 8 million push-ups and sit-ups. And I'm, you know, in relatively good shape." And this was also like 20 years ago, so I was probably in much better shape then. And I didn't hear anything back for like a month. And finally, the department head at the University of Arizona, she said, "Did you ever hear back?" And I said, "No." And she called out there. And the next day I got this letter from Admiral Larson telling me you can come. And so Larson later told me that the delay was that he thought that the letter was a joke, because he couldn't believe somebody was volunteering to go through the Plebe Summer. Wow. So he was sharing this letter with all these people as if it was a joke. And finally somebody said, "You know, this actually might be serious." And then my boss called and said, "You know, the kid is waiting to find out if he can come out there or not." So I told McCain this whole story, and he goes, "I told you to tell me a story I didn't know. I already knew that story." And I'm like, "You knew that story?" He said, "I knew that story the day I met you." And I'm like, "You did?" He's like, "Because Chuck called me up and said, this crazy person from Arizona wants to come here and do research. What do I do about this?" And he read the letter to McCain, and McCain said, "Well, he must be serious about it, so let him come." So he also inadvertently ended up being in part responsible for my being even able to go there.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. So you see now why I got really emotional when he died, because, you know, even though he's not somebody I have exactly a personal interaction with on a regular basis, nice enough. And then Seth, like a week after he died, his wife's secretary called.
Yeah.
And says, "We're going through all those papers. Do you want the papers that have your name on the file?" And I'm like, "My name is on it." So what they send me, this is a copy of the last version of the book before it got published, so that he could read the book and then write the foreword from it.
No way. Yeah,
so he literally touched all this, but anyway.
Oh my gosh.
So it was really funny. So I said yes, and then one day one of the secretaries in the department goes, "Oh my god, John McCain sent you something, and he's dead." And I'm like,
from beyond the grave.
Yes, from beyond the grave. I got mail from John McCain.
Yeah, he truly was a once-in-a-lifetime person.
Yeah, a really, really super guy. I didn't agree with most of his politics, but, yeah. You know, that's neither here nor there. He was just, at the end of it, just a very nice person.
Yeah, sounds like it. So, sounds like you really, you know, look up to John McCain and draw inspiration from him. Is there anyone else that you sort of, you know, connect with, draw inspiration from?
Sure, lots of people. So, Seth, do you see that broken door behind the door?
Yes.
So, that door came from the house of a guy named Charles Gatewood. Have you ever heard of Charles Gatewood?
I have not.
So, do you know the Indian leader who's named Geronimo?
Mm-mm. Oh, wait, yes, I do know Geronimo. Yes.
So, Geronimo very famously kept the American army chasing him for a decade in Arizona, New Mexico, and in Mexico. And there was an army officer who befriended him, who was named Charles Gatewood. And befriended him to such a degree that he learned the Chiricahua Apache language and used to hang out with Geronimo in Geronimo's camp.
Really?
And when it was the sort of pressure was on for Geronimo to surrender, he's the individual who rode horseback about 35 miles, found Geronimo in a canyon, and convinced Geronimo to surrender. And that guy was from Harrisonburg.
No way.
And that door is from his house.
Wow. Yeah.
So when the guy who owns it was doing some work in the house, he called me up and said, I'm going to get rid of this trashy door. Do you want it? And I was like, of course. So there it sits on. Yeah. So Gatewood, he's one of the few people. He was from Harrisonburg. He graduated from West Point.
Mm-hmm.
And he never killed an Indian person because he was so religious. I'm not terribly religious, but his religious sentiment was such that you love people, you don't kill people.
Yeah.
So he went to all this extent to learn the language, and then his papers are actually kept at the University of Arizona. So when I was out there one summer, I read all of the papers. He was out in all these different little towns in Arizona collecting money for donations for the Chiricahua Apache.
That's amazing.
Anyway, so that's somebody who inspires me a great deal. And then I guess, you know, there's like this whole host of other people. There's
yeah. All right. So as an historian, what do you think is the importance of oral history? Do you think it's as credible as written history? And do you think that it should be something that should be looked into more?
Well, for that dissertation, I interviewed 350 people roughly at the Naval Academy. So yeah, I'm very big on oral history. Especially where we are today when people don't write letters anymore. And paperwork is just simply not generated anymore. Andrew is sitting over there in front of those two blue containers that are filled with all these photocopies of things that I got from the archives at the Naval Academy. But people don't print that shit up anymore. So when you look at today's world where we are in terms of communication, oral history becomes very, very important because that is mostly the only way you're ever going to get to know stories.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that I really like about it is it really brings a human face into archival material. So, for example, like one of the things I was doing, I was attempting to interview all of the people who were in the top two positions at the Naval Academy from 1949 when I started until 2000 when I finished. And when you read people's papers, you know, you sort of get a sense of them a little bit, but mostly not. Then when you sit one-on-one with them, it all kind of starts coming together, and you sort of get a sense from what people tell you. Are they bullshitting you? Are they being serious? Did they drink Kool-Aid? You know, you really get an idea of who they are. And so that's like one of the great like joys that I have had as a historian, is doing oral history projects, because it really allows you to talk to people who can fill in answers to the questions that you have, who can tell you the details that are not written down. Just as an example, like Gloria Steinem was the first woman ever invited to the Naval Academy. Do you know who Gloria Steinem is?
I've heard the name.
She's a very famous feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Who started the most important women's magazine. It's called Ms. Magazine.
Okay.
And she was very famous. She, for a writing assignment, she dressed up as a Playboy bunny for one of Hugh Hefner's Playboy clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And served as a waitress. You asked earlier about my earlier life. My parents used to take me to the Playboy clubs around New York City as a little child. I can remember the whole thing so vividly because as a little kid, it was, you know, not as much a sexual thing. It's just like, there's women dressed up as rabbits. Like, what's the deal with that? And they were bringing around drinks and bringing me Shirley Temples, and it was all very exciting. I can remember that so vividly. So she did that and then wrote a series of articles that exposed the sexual harassment, the rape that went on with this whole system, and then subsequently became this very famous feminist leader. So when I found in the paperwork that she was the first woman to be invited, I sent her a letter and I was like, is there any way that I can interview you? And she was like, of course. And she was like, she called me up and it was the most amazing thing because it's not very often that I get to interview like super famous people.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, she was laughing. She said, in a million years, I would never have remembered that I even went to the Naval Academy. And in order to rile everybody up, it's this very, very famous moment in the history of the Naval Academy because they got the entire student body together in an auditorium. And when she saw that it was all guys and there was literally not another woman, the first thing she said is, to get everybody riled up, she said, and I'll quote, there's no job I can think of that requires a penis or a vagina. And then there's just this uproar, people booing like, what the fuck? And all this
stuff. Yeah.
And all of the guys who were there very, very vividly remember it. The admiral, who was the head of the school at the time, very vividly remembered the whole thing. And then I interview her, and she dumps forward all this information, which none of them shared with me about the experience. And I'm like, holy fuck. And it was great. We were on the phone for like 2 hours. The next day she calls me back again because the conversation just kind of like evoked all these other memories about that day. So I would know none of that without having had done that oral history. And on the other side, I calculated it was about a 14% reply rate to the letters that I sent requesting interviews.
Wow.
And then as soon as that book got published, somewhere in the drawer here, I have the hate mail file. All of these people are like, you got this story wrong. Why the fuck did you say this when it was that? And they were all people that I'd asked for interviews. So I handwrote them all letters back and I said, I'm sorry that you don't feel that this is how it happened. I said, because that's part of what's in those blue folders. I kept carbon copies of everything I sent out. I said, on like April 24th of 1999, I sent you a letter asking you for an interview. You never replied. So therefore I cannot know this. So that just sort of underscores how important that is to really get people. Now, they may or may not be telling you the truth, but at least you're going to get some ideas. Like the very first guy who I interviewed was the dean of students when women came. And he was fairly old at the time. He lived in some suburb of D.C. and I drove out to his house and he was very lovely. We sat down on his back porch. He made us sweet tea. And he looked at me and he said, I've read everything you sent me and this is what I don't understand. And I said, okay, with a smile on his face. He says, you're making women out to seem like some big deal. We were told they were coming. We made it work. So why do we have any questions? And I know damn well women were raped, sexually harassed, the whole nine yards. And he's acting like none of it happened. And I'm like, you really don't think any of those things happened? He's like, if any of that had happened, I would have known about it. I'm like, okay.
All right.
So, yes, I do think oral history is incredibly important, but on its own may not help you that much. When it's backed up with the archival material, the newspapers, then it's very, very useful. Very useful.
Okay. Only two more questions left. The next one is, as a professor, what is one thing that you hope all of your students take away from your class?
Well, the one thing that they're not going to take away is any information, because they're all going to brain dump the information. So basically, I think at this stage of my teaching career, however many years, the first class I taught was in 2000, so we're 18 years in, is to try to encourage people to read and to think for themselves. Those are the two most important things that it really I can do, because most people are not going to remember. Andrew took like 7 classes. Andrew doesn't remember a single fucking thing that he learned in any of my classes, I can guarantee you. But people need to be reminded all the time to keep reading, keep learning. The knowledge base continues to expand exponentially every hour. And in order to keep on top of things, you need to keep reading all this stuff. And this is what I would say. Yeah, this is what is the most helpful thing that I can try to do to encourage people. But I think also, you know, then as you have probably gathered, there are some students with whom I develop personal interactions because they're just awesome people. And with those people, I would say I'm trying to encourage them to live good lives. You know, do interesting things. This is the only thing about my life which has been really awesome, is that most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time when given unusual opportunities, I've just gone with the flow and just done them. And as a result, I've ended up meeting a whole bunch of interesting people, interacting with a whole bunch, having strange and interesting interactions. Because you know what? When you put yourself out there, things happen. And that's an important life lesson. It's the only thing that has really been interesting about my life. When I look back, like if I were to die today and look back at all the things that were interesting, they've all been about the moments where I was just like, fuck it, just go balls out and just do whatever. Because
yeah,
if you're given an opportunity and you don't take it, what might happen? You know, all sorts of things happen. You meet people, you know, have these things take place. It's very interesting. That was not a very good answer.
That was a very good answer. All right, so my last question is, what do you want people to take away from your story? What do you want the listeners to hear and, you know, get from your story?
From my story?
Yes.
Just keep exploring, because you never know what you're going to learn about yourself. And keep talking to people who knew you when you were young and knew you along the way, because in the process of the whole thing about finding out about my adoption, I have found out just by asking all the people that are aware of it things and pieced together a lot more than I knew, because everybody had little tiny pieces. But just keep talking to people, because this is one of the things that I find interesting. Like, just as an example, a few years ago I started talking to people randomly on the subway in New York. Now I do it all the fucking time. And then what you find out is that you have all these unusual things in common with people that you would never know if you didn't just simply sit and talk to people. And then you end up with people that you interact with later on. This is how half the people I'm friends with on Twitter or Instagram, how I know them. Like, Seth, I'll give you an example. One last story. Okay. So, I don't even think I told Andrew this story, but so in August, I was giving this conference paper at a place called Santa Clara University out in California. And I was going to be there for enough days that I was going to have some kind of transportation. Normally, one, if you're in a big city, you just use the public transit. If you're not going to be in a big city, you get a car or whatever. You provide a budget to JMU. JMU pays for all of it, whatever. So San Jose doesn't really have very good public transit. And I knew that because the conference was going to go late in the day, and there's no real restaurant scene around the campus where I was staying, I was going to want to get somehow to the downtown of San Jose to eat at restaurants. So I proposed getting a bike. So JMU finally agreed to let me get a bike. I rented a bike. And it was fucking awesome. And so one of the things that I was just sort of like doing was every day as soon as the conference was over, I got on the bike. Well, I went and changed. I got rid of the tie. And then I plodded from basically from Santa Clara to the downtown of San Jose, which is about 6 miles, plotted a different route each day. The destination was the same restaurant, because it's a restaurant I'm obsessed with, a taco restaurant. This is so fucking good. And then every night afterward, I just went and tooled around in San Jose and just explored. So the last night that I was there, it was Saturday night. I get done with dinner. I'm all excited about life. Well, San Jose State University is this huge college campus in the downtown of San Jose. And I've taught about it. I've read about it. There's a lot of significant and important people who went to school there. For example, Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day, went to school there. A lot of interesting people. So I go over there, and I'm just kind of like astounded because the place is stunningly beautiful. So I'm just like on the bike, and I'm just like taking it all in. And somebody taps me on the shoulder, and it's a group of Punjabi kids. And they want to know if I'll play cricket with them. And I look, and they've got the whole paddle and everything. I'm like, I would be happy to watch you play, but I do not know anything about it. But, and they would think, come watch us. And they barely speak English. They were just students there, and they were awesome. And we had this really great time, and I was like very stoked about life. So I hang out with them for a little while, and then I notice that it's going to be coming to about the time of the sunset. And the Bay Area is surrounded by mountains, and I'm thinking to myself, it would be beautiful. So I'm trying to figure out, how can I get up high so I can see above the buildings? So I see this parking garage. So I hike up with the bike to the top of this parking garage and just watch the sun go down, just glowing on all the mountains. And I'm like, oh, fuck, this is so beautiful, this place. And I'm hearing this noise that sounds like construction noise. And I'm like, why would there be construction on Saturday? Well, it turns out it's not construction noise. It turns out it's this group of about 80 kids half students, half alumni from San Jose State, who are in this organization preparing for this Ganesh Festival. This was in August. The Ganesh Festival is in September. Ooh. So they all have these enormous drums that are made out of steel, like basically like drums, sort of like Jamaican, mm-hmm. but just much bigger. And they have all of these animal hides that are all covered with Sanskrit, and they're all just like pounding. I've never heard anything like this in unison. That's what the noise was that I thought was construction noise.
Wow.
So half of them are drumming, the other half are doing this dance, which is unlike anything else. And I'm just sitting there going, what the fuck am I looking at here? It was like measuring. It was so loud because it was in between buildings that it was making my heart skip. And it was just like I was in a trance. And they stopped to take a break, and these kids came over to me, and they were like, we don't ever have an audience. Who are you? And I'm like, I'm just the guy from the East Coast, and I'm here. And they're like, and you came here? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, what the fuck? I'm like, I know. And I'm like, and what are you doing? And they explained the whole thing to me, and it's the only group of musicians that performs this particular thing in North America.
Wow.
And because they're the only one, and it's in the middle of Silicon Valley, so it's all these people from India, they are live broadcast back to India. And I'm like, what the fuck? This is so crazy. So they get done. I go on my way. I go a few buildings over, and I come upon this statue, and I'm like, I'm just mesmerized. You know the famous Black Power salute at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics?
Yes.
The two dudes who are black were students at San Jose State at the time. So the center of the campus is this, like, three times larger than life statue of them.
And that's amazing.
Like, this is so fucking cool. And I'm like standing there, and I'm just like taking it in, and some dude taps me on the shoulder, and I turn around, and it's this African American guy, and he goes, can I ask who you are and what you're doing? And I'm like, yeah. And I tell him my whole thing, and he's like, so let me get this straight. You came all the way here, you got a bike, and now you're just tooling around on our campus? And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, who are you? And he goes, oh, I'm actually kind of doing the same thing you're doing. And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah. And I'm like, what's your deal? And he goes, well, I grew up in Tucson, and I'm like, which is my adopted hometown. And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, I have a computer science degree from University of Arizona, and I work for Intel, and I work, and he points at this building, and goes, I work in that building, and I look out at this campus every day, and tonight was the night to come after work and kind of tool around on the campus. So we get into this huge conversation. He has an Instagram account that's called Everyday Encounters, which is all about exactly what I'm talking about, which is just randomly talking to people. So we sit down on the lawn in front of this big statue, the Black Power statue, and he's doing exactly what you're doing. Interviews me, puts me on Instagram.
Really?
And then we go on our way. And I'm just like, I'm on the bike, and it's now pretty late at night, and it's Saturday night, and I'm just like, this has been one of the strangest evenings of my life. And I'm just trying to, like, take the whole thing in. So I'm on a side street, and I'm about ready to get onto the main street through the downtown of San Jose, which is a big city, and then ride that back to the campus. So I'm at this traffic light, and all of a sudden, this mass of probably 200 to 300 people on scooters, skateboards, rollerblades, bikes, all combined. Everybody is wearing, like, you know, those, like, necklaces that are, like, neon color, and some people are pushing baby strollers, and there's music blaring, and I'm like, what the fuck? So I have no idea what this is. The light changes. I pedal as fast as possible. I catch up to the end of this mass of people, and I'm, like, riding alongside of these two women that are on a tandem bike, and I'm like, what is this? And they're like, we don't know. We're just from Germany, and we just saw these people riding, so we joined them. I'm like, what the fuck? So I go further up, and this guy says, oh, this is called San Jose Skate Night. And I'm like, what the fuck is San Jose Skate Night? And the guy goes, every Saturday, there's a Facebook page you can look up. It's just called San Jose Skate Night. And the guy who runs it says, meet at this intersection. And hundreds of people show up who do not know each other. Some of them are high, some are not high, some have babies, some of them are kids, some are in costume, some are like professional cyclists, and just as a communal activity, they ride 3 or 4 miles together through the downtown of San Jose. Wow. It's always a different route, never the same people. So I just rode around with them. And everyone's like, who are you? And I'm just like, meet all these people. I'm like, I got back to the dorm room that night, and I was just like, what in the name of God. If I had not gotten this bicycle, this entire evening would not have happened.
Yeah.
And here I just interact with people from all over the world in fucking San Jose. It was one of the most memorable nights of my entire life. That's what I'm talking about when I say be open to when random things happen, just go with it. Because you never know what the fuck's going to happen.
Yeah.
Now, I'll probably never see or talk to any of those people ever again.
But at least you have the experience.
But it was a moment.
Yeah.
You know, a moment of interaction with fellow humans.
That's amazing. Thank you very much for sharing your story. You're
very welcome, Seth.
It has been a pleasure interviewing you.
And you.
Thank you very much.